Nevada. My name is Rachel, and I'm an alcoholic. Sam, thank you so much for asking me to come out and share my experience, strength, and hope. It's an absolute honor to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. First, I want to say I have a sobriety date. It's February 5th of 2014. I'm actively sponsored. I sponsor other women in the program, and I have service positions. And I don't say those things to pat myself on the back or be like, hurrah, I'm a great AA member. I just know those things keep me sober today, you know. And for me, you know, if you don't hear anything I say tonight, the one thing that I really, really, really firmly believe is I love Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, through and through. It is the absolute center of my life today. And I really believe, like, had I not found the rooms of AA when I did, I would not be here and you would have a different speaker tonight, you know. And I guess I'll just tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And, you know, for me, none of the stuff I'm about to say makes me an alcoholic. I want to make that very, very clear. It's just sort of like the circumstances of my life and how, looking back, I see my alcoholism, like, before I even took a drink, you know. And for me, I was born in Alabama, raised in Georgia, and I have, like, the typical white picket fence, mom, dad, a couple dogs, and a sister. We have a great family, you know. And I was given everything I ever wanted and everything I ever needed, you know. And I know for me, I was in the fifth grade and I moved to Potomac, Maryland, which I don't know if anybody here knows where that is or what that is, but it is a very wealthy area, okay. And for me, what happened is it became a very competitive area. And I showed up on the first day of fifth grade in some, like, overalls, didn't have my hair brushed, had some cowboy boots on, said things like y'all and butter, and I was, like, tortured. I mean, like, tortured, ripped apart, you know. And, like, it was the first day, you know. And that's, like, the first resentment I ever can, like, really remember, you know. And what I learned really those first couple days was that, like, I had to pretend to be something that I wasn't so that you would like me, you know. And I didn't know that at the time. I was in the fifth grade, you know. But looking back, you know, that's a common theme of what Rachel does, right, and how Rachel succeeds. And, you know, for me, from the very beginning, you know, I am someone where if you tell me I can't have something or I can't do something, I'm going to do whatever I have to do to get it and to do it, you know. And I remember one time I was in the grocery store with my dad, and I wanted a pack of, like, Lifesaver gummies. We were in the checkout line, and I said, Dad, you know, can I please have these Lifesaver gummies? And he said, no. I mean, to this day, my dad will never, you know, buy me anything or let me get anything unless it's a book. And as soon as he turned his back, I took those gummies, I opened them, and I started eating them in the store. You know, like, I just, even though my parents taught me right from wrong, instilled, like, the best morals they possibly could, you know, I'm like, selfish, you know. I want what I want, and when I want it right then. And really what happened for me is when I was in high school, I really wanted to be that popular girl, right? I would see these popular girls with their Abercrombie and Fitch clothes and their super expensive jeans, driving their Mercedes, and I would yell at my parents because they wouldn't give me those things, you know. And so what I did was I started stealing those things. I started pretending to be somebody I wasn't, and one day somebody offered me a drink. And I always like to share my first drink because it's a complete snapshot of seven to 9 years of drinking. And so my first drink was in a basement kind of like this. It had no windows. It was dripping water. I was probably 15 or 16 at the time, hanging out with, like, 20-year-old men, 25-year-old men. And I had 2 40 ounces taped to both of my hands. And it was this game that back, I don't know if kids still play it, but it was this game we called Edward 40 Hands. And you had 2 40s taped to your hands, and you could not use them until you drank both of those 40 ounces and smashed the empty bottles, right? And so that was my first drink, you know. And neither of my parents drink alcohol because they're not alcoholic, you know. It's not like they're like, oh, I have this abnormal relationship with alcohol, so I'm not drinking. Like, they just, alcohol does not do for them what it does for me, you know. And so I really think for me, right, like, leading up to that first drink, I would, like, watch TV, and I would see all these, like, I don't know, I guess they were young adults. I don't really even know how old they were, like partying on MTV and VH1. And like, that was my goal, right? Like, that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be somebody who party all day, had no responsibilities. And after that first drink, I can't tell you that, like, I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is the solution to all of my problems. I don't think I felt that way. You know, I think I just, one, I felt a part of, right? Like, I felt like, you know, I was one amongst many. And I also stopped caring what other people thought about me. You know, that is, like, something that's really, really, even today, can be a really big hurdle for me is, you know, I'm so consumed in what you think about me, you know? And what's so funny is I had this girlfriend. She was a friend of mine, not my girlfriend, but a friend of mine, who she was there that night, right? And she had a couple of drinks. She did not have the Edward 40 hands. She didn't do that, but she did have a couple of drinks. And we both woke up the next day, and she said, I'm never going to do that ever again. That was horrible. And I was like, you must be out of your mind. You know, I was like, that was the greatest thing that's ever happened to me, you know? And I didn't know then, but I love the effect produced by alcohol, you know, and I'm not here to bash alcohol. I'm not here to say, oh, it destroyed my life and it's this horrible thing. The reality is I gave away everything good and decent in my life for a drink. I gave it away, you know, and alcohol did not do that to me. I did that myself, you know, and for me, I really relate in the book when it describes the female alcoholic, you know. I don't know anything about social drinking. I never had a social drink in my life. You know, that's just my experience, you know. My experience is after that first drink, I chased every drink like that, you know. I used to tell myself, like, oh, maybe if I could drink like a lady, which in my mind was like having a glass of wine, I was like, you know, maybe I could be a non-alcoholic. Maybe I could be a normal drinker, you know. And I drank wine once in my life, and it was out of a bag while someone was slapping it, yelling chug. You know what I mean? Like, that's how I drink. I drink to oblivion, you know. I drink to forget who and what I am. You know, I drink to forget the decisions that I made the night before. I drink to forget the decisions I made while I was sober, the things that I had to do to get that next drink, you know. And the first couple of years of my drinking were really fun, you know. I had a good time, you know. I would dance on top of ping pong tables. I would, you know, do these things that, like, I never thought I could do. You know, I tried out for the cheerleading squad, and I was head cheerleader. You know, I started dating this, like, football player, and I thought, you know, like, I had arrived, right? I had made it. You know, these were going to be the best years of my life, you know? And what happened for me is, unlike the rest of my friends who started applying for college, taking AP courses, you know, getting their prom dresses, you know, I was leaving school to go drink behind the school. You know, I started smoking cigarettes. And like I said, you know, some of the things that I gave up, I was a really big dancer. I loved dance. It was my whole life. It was, you know, sort of like before I started drinking, I feel like I put all my effort into dancing, you know, like that was my cure to life, you know, was to dance. And one day I was drunk at high school and I fell down a flight of stairs, sprained my ankle, and I was drunk at the time, you know, and I just got back up and kind of like skipped out to this car where I was going to leave with some senior to go to out for lunch, right? And what happened was is I slammed that same foot into the car door, you know. To be honest, like, I do dance at AA events. It's a lot of fun. But, like, you know, my dream was to dance professionally, and I never got to chase that dream, you know, because I'm forever, like, injured. I have a lot of complications with that foot. And, you know, that was just, like, one of the early circumstances of my drinking, just one of the early ones, you know. Really what happened for me is at the age of 19, my parents said, like, hey, we don't like the way that you're living your life. You're doing things you shouldn't be doing. And my response was, Mom, everybody's doing it. You know, everybody's doing it. And the truth was is they weren't. You know, my truth was is I was just hanging out with people that were drinking the way that I was drinking so I could feel better about myself. You know, so I could tell myself, oh, I'm not that bad, you know. And so what happened for me is I went to rehab at 19, you know, and I'm really grateful for that institution, because they were 12-step based, right? They talked to me about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. They talked to me about getting a sponsor. They talked to me about going to 90 meetings in 90 days, but I didn't get sober, you know. I went there because my mom told me if I didn't go to rehab, I was going to be homeless, and I was not ready to be homeless, you know. And I feel like I did not have the life skills to continue drinking the way I wanted to drink. And so I went to that rehab. And, you know, what's so funny, right, is, you know, I'm 19 years old. I definitely feel like at that time, right, like I was qualified to be alcoholic. And what I mean by that is, you know, I never tried to stop drinking. That's just not my experience. I never was like, oh, I'm going to try to be sober for a week. I didn't do that. So, one, like, there's a hint right there, right? Non-alcoholics don't typically do that. But really, for me, you know, what I had discovered in about 3 to 4 years of drinking is that when I took a drink, I could not control the amount I took. I could not. I could not tell you if I was going to have 2 drinks, go home to my parents' house, kiss my mom on the cheek, tell her I loved her, go to bed, wake up to go to school the next day, or if I was going to be missing for 4 days. You know, I had no idea. And even though I had that abnormal relationship with alcohol and I was in that rehab and those physicians said, we have a solution for you, all you have to do is take it, I didn't want it. You know, and they said, all right, we're going to send you to Florida because maybe Maryland's the problem. And I was like, that sounds right. You know, that sounds, I don't think I can get sober and stay sober in Maryland. And so I did my first geographical, and I moved down to South Florida, which at the time was like the rehab capital of the world and also the relapse capital of the world. And, you know, I went down there. They said, oh, you're going to go to this all-women's house. I was like, no, I'm not. You know, I don't like women. I'm not going to go to some all-women's recovery house. Like, you know what I mean? And so they were like, all right, we'll send you to this, this like, halfway house facility. And so I went there, right? And what happened was is I was down there for maybe, I don't know, maybe like 6 months, right? I'm, like, going to some AA meetings. I have this sponsor by name. I'm not working any steps. You know, I'm talking during the meeting. I'm getting up, walking around. Like, I did not want what you guys had. I didn't want it. And, you know, that's why I tell people, you know, if you come in here and you don't want it, you will not get it. That's my experience. You know, I did not get it because my family wanted it for me. You know, I did not get sober because people said, oh, Rachel, you're such a lovely person when you're sober. We hate it when you drink. You know, I just, it didn't happen for me. But what did happen is I got a hostage of a boyfriend. And this poor, poor hostage of a boyfriend, he lived one building over in the halfway house. And we fell in love. And we had a plan, right? We had this beautiful newcomer plan. And this beautiful newcomer plan was we were going to move out of the halfway house. My mom was going to get us an apartment a mile from the beach. We were both going to get jobs, stay sober, and live happily ever after, right? It sounds like a good plan. Even now it sounds like a good plan, you know? I'm like, that sounds pretty nice. But what happened was is we got that apartment, we both got jobs, and I was drinking 2 weeks later, you know? And you know, that hostage of a boyfriend, like, he suffers from what we suffer from, and he is not sober, you know, and I pray for him every night, you know, and I put him through, you know, through a lot, and, you know, I wish I could say that when I started drinking down in Florida that it wasn't horrible, you know, but the only way I can describe that time of my life is that it was absolutely pathetic and disgusting, you know. It was not cute. It was not fun. They were the darkest years of my life, you know, and what happened down there is, you know, like the big book describes, right? I drew all these lines in the sand, and I said, you know, I'm never going to do this. I'm never going to be that person. And every time I said that, I would do those things, and I became that person. And, you know, I feel like I lost a little part of myself every time I took a drink, you know. And I don't want to say slowly but surely because it was not slowly. You know, I'm the type of alcoholic where I drink to oblivion every time I drink, you know. And I had to do a lot of things that, like, I'm not proud of, but I'm also not ashamed of today, you know. You know, through the grace of God and with you guys, I've been able to work the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and go back to Florida and right a lot of my wrongs there, you know, and make those amends. But what I can tell you is by the end of it, right, I lived in this apartment that was fully furnished by the people who owned it, and I sold all the furniture in that house. I can tell you that I had a towel taped over my mirror in the bathroom because I couldn't get up and go to the bathroom and look at myself. I was 86 pounds. I had my hair up in a bun, and everybody thought that, like, I just wore my hair that way, but the reality was is I didn't have a hair tie, that my hair was totally matted because I hadn't showered in months. every single job that I ever got, I quit because somebody, you know, my employer was like, hey, we're really worried about you. Something's going on, you know, and I knew that they were going to fire me, so I had to leave that job. You know, that wonderful, loving family, which, you know, if love could have gotten me sober, I would have gotten sober a long time ago. You know, they loved and loved me, you know, to the moon and back. And for that, I'm very grateful because not everybody has that, you know. And I thank my mom every day. Part of my amends to her is to call her every day on my lunch break, and I thank her every day for not giving up on me. You know, I really believe that if she cut me off and didn't talk to me, that you would have a different speaker tonight, you know, because what happened for me is that 86-pound girl who was drinking every single day, you know, drinking before going to the grocery store because I couldn't come in contact with people, who had to get drawstrings in her jeans and her pants because I couldn't even fit into the smallest size of the store, you know, waking up every day asking God to kill me. You know, I was not someone that was like, oh, I'm not going to drink till 5 o'clock. You know, the moment I woke up and my eyes opened, I was like, how am I going to get what I need to get today to just get through the day, right? And that doesn't have to be your experience. It's just my experience, you know. And I know for me, you know, that hostage of a boyfriend, he left, right? Like, I mean, obviously, you know, because I'm someone, which when I heard it for the first time in the rooms, I laughed because I related so much, right? Like, if you lose your wallet, I'm going to help you find it while it's in my back pocket. You know what I mean? Like, that's the type of person I am, you know? And, you know, I pushed that man so far away that he could not watch the person that I was becoming, you know, the shell of a human that I had become. And I was asking God every single day to kill me. You know, I said, just take it all away. Like, I don't want to do this anymore. And that prayer was answered. It just didn't look that way. What happened was I was driving around doing things I wasn't supposed to be doing with people I wasn't supposed to be doing it with. And I got pulled over. You know, I did not come running in the rooms of AA like, oh, I just want to get sober. You know, I was forced into the rooms of AA. And what happened for me is I got arrested for having my driver's side mirror. I had like hit, I think it was a recycling bin a couple of nights before, and I had knocked that mirror off, and apparently it's illegal to drive a vehicle with no driver's side mirror. And so I got pulled over, right? And I had a lot of illegal things in my vehicles that are outside issues, and you know, I think most police don't look favorably upon that, you know, and I was arrested. And the only time I had ever been arrested before was for stealing a Mountain Dew in a grocery store. So, you know, I'm not a hardened criminal. You know, I'm not good at getting away with things, you know. And so I was in jail, and I remember, and I hope I never forget. I really do. I hope I never forget walking through that jail. I thought I looked so good. I had these, like, jean cut-off shorts. I had this little plaid shirt that I tied up, and I had these hoop earrings. Meanwhile, my skin is gray. I'm dying from alcoholism. I'm 86 pounds, and I couldn't even eat the bologna sandwich that they gave me. You know what I mean? And I'm dying from alcoholism. And I remember walking through that jail, and as I'm, it's called Gun Club, so I feel like the name in and of itself like describes the type of facility that it is. And I'm walking through that like jail cell, and they're taking me to the women's holding cell, and there are all these men just banging on the glass, screaming and yelling, and I'm terrified. For the first time in my life, I'm terrified. And you know, I will say that fear did get me sober in the beginning. You know, I was scared. I remember sitting in that jail cell thinking, like, how did I get here? You know, how did this good little girl who only wanted the best in life, how did I wind up here? And I feel like my first miracle happened there because, you know, my family at this time, I had no relationship with them. You know, my mom, I was living this double life, right, where my mom thought I was sober. She thought I was sponsoring people and speaking at AA meetings down in Florida. And, you know, they were 1,000 miles away, and I was sitting in this jail cell, and there was this really, really, really big African-American woman sitting across the cell just staring at me. And I was like, this is it, right? Like, this is it. This is going to be my life. And the problem with gun club is you can only dial local numbers. And I didn't have a single person to call that day, not a single person. I had no friends. I had nobody that I could call to help me. And, you know, I remember talking to the sheriff as they were walking by. I was like, I just need to call my mom, but she's not local. I just need to call an out-of-state number. And he looked at me and he said, too bad, you know. And this woman that was sitting across the cell, she looks at me and she said, honey, I'm going to call my sister and give me your mom's telephone number, and she'll call your mom on three-way and you can talk to her. And I don't know this woman. I'm terrified of this woman. You know, I think this woman's going to, like, beat me up or do something. I don't know, you know. And, you know, I feel like, you know, that was the grace of God, you know. And that's not to say that I received grace and someone else didn't. You know, it's just my experience. There's no way that I can explain that event happening. And so this woman called her sister, and I gave her my mom's number, and she called my mom, and I said, Mom, I'm in a lot of trouble, you know, and I need help. And I had said that so many times, right? I mean, I told my mom that I had, like, all these medical issues, and she needed to Western Union me money, and she needed to put money in my bank account, and she probably did that 200 times, you know. And for whatever reason, I guess in that moment, you know, she knew. Like, she knew that I really needed help. And she said, honey, we'll take care of it. I'm going to come find you, you know. And I remember the sheriff telling me, all right, you're going to go upstairs. And once you're upstairs, you cannot get bailed out. You're going to have to go to, I guess, like, your initial court hearing, right? And so I was just, I remember, like, praying in that cell, that foxhole prayer, right? I'm like, God, if you just get me out of this, I promise you I'll never drink again, you know. And I had probably said that prayer a number of times, you know, and never meant it, but I did mean it that night. I really did. And I remember saying, you know, I'll do whatever you want me to do. Just get me out. And I feel like it was probably 4 or 5 in the morning, and they said, all right, you know, they said, Rachel, you're going to go ahead and get on out, right? So I went out. I had this clear little plastic bag of my belongings. I had my big hoop earrings and a cell phone, you know, and that was it. That's all I had, you know. And I walked out of that jail, excuse me, and as I was stepping out, there were 2 cabs. That was it. My mom wasn't there. The hostage of a boyfriend wasn't there. You know, all of the friends I thought I had, the people that didn't go to jail because I went to jail, they did not come and pick me up. You know, it was just me and those 2 cabs. And one of the cab drivers looked like a guy off Duck Dynasty, which is like this TV show that I watched on repeat while I was drinking. And I was like, I feel like that guy's probably safe. Maybe I'll ask him to take me home. And, you know, I walked up to that cab, and I told him, I said, I have no money. I have no way to pay you, but I just want to go home. You know, and he took me home. And that whole ride home, he was just a person. You know, he didn't ask me what happened. He didn't ask me if I was dying of alcoholism and needed a solution. He just said, honey, it's going to be okay. And he said, I hope you have somebody you can call. And when I got home to this little apartment that had no furniture, all I had in the fridge was a 2-liter of Mountain Dew and some cheese because that's all I could eat. My mom called me and she said, you know, a lawyer's going to come pick you up and you're going to go to rehab. And I said, okay. You know, I didn't have some witty, you know, if you knew me, I'm very sarcastic. I'm a very sarcastic person and sometimes to a fault. But, you know, that day I didn't have anything to say. I just said, okay, I'll go, you know. And don't get me wrong. I was like, maybe I can get one more drink, you know, maybe just one more. And luckily, right as I had that thought, I heard a very familiar knock on the door. And there was this man in a suit who just looked too uppity for my likes, you know. And he said, you know, hi, your mom sent me, and I'm here to take you to rehab. And I said, okay. He said, pack a bag, we're going to go, right? So I packed my little bag. I didn't have any clean clothes, so everything I owned was dirty. And we took about, I guess it was probably about a half an hour, 45-minute ride to West Palm Beach, Florida. And I get to this rehab, and they wrap me up in this little fleece blanket. And I remember praying. I said, okay, God, you got me here. I'll do what I have to do, right? Well, as I was doing my intake, my heart stopped. And, you know, I woke up 3 weeks later on the 6th floor of a hospital, handcuffed to a bed with a police officer outside my door, and I had no idea what happened. And, you know, come to find out, I feel like, you know, the longer I've stayed sober, you know, I've had little memory bubbles, whatever, you know, I don't know what they are, but, you know, I remember having, you know, potassium infusions, which is a very, very, very painful infusion to have, you know, because both my kidneys failed and my heart stopped. And it was a direct result of alcoholism. You know, and I remember them asking me if I knew what day it was, and I didn't know. They asked me who the president was, and I didn't know. And I closed my eyes, and I woke up another week later, and my mother was sitting across from me, and she looked at me, and she said, are you done? And I told her I didn't know, you know. because I didn't know. I could not imagine, you know, a life without drinking. But I also knew if I continued to do what I was doing, I was going to die. And you know, personally, like, I didn't want to do that to my family. My family are really good people. And, you know, I just know for me, like, I didn't want to lie to her anymore. I didn't want to say, you know what, Mom, I've had enough and this is it. Because for someone like me, you know, alcohol is the solution to my life. It allows me to go about and pretend to be a normal person, you know. I knew for a fact I was never going to be someone who woke up at 6 a.m., got in their normal car, drove to their normal job, and was just a person. I knew that was never going to be me. And, you know, what I didn't know at that time and what I found out when I had a year sober is that when I called my mom from that jail, she hopped on a plane and she flew down to Florida. And because of HIPAA regulations, once you're hospitalized, if you don't give them permission to talk to certain people, they will not tell anyone where you are. And my mother drove all over the state of southern Florida looking at 5 different hospitals to find out where her daughter was. And what happened was, is the hospital that I was at, she was crying in the parking lot outside of her car, sobbing. And a nurse who had just gotten off duty, she said, I'm just looking for my daughter. I'm just looking for my baby girl, and I don't know where she is. And that nurse, for whatever reason, she said, I'm going to go in there and see if she's here. And that nurse put her job on the line to go in there and look on that computer and see if I was there, and I was there. And she came back, and she told my mom, and that's how my mom found me. You know, and if that's not God, I don't know what is, you know. And, you know, my mom told me that when I got my 1-year chip and gave it to her. You know, and the other thing my mom told me when I got my 1 year is that my sister, who has autism, who works at Home Depot mixing paint, had put all of her money in a savings account and gave it to my mom to pay for my funeral because she knew that my mom and dad wouldn't be able to do it, you know. And that's what I do to people. Like, that's what my alcoholism does. You know, it doesn't look cute and fun, you know. I destroy relationships. I hurt people, you know, and at the time, you know, that those weren't my intentions. You know, at the time, it was just like, I have to do this. I have no other choice, you know. And what I could say, you know, I wish I could tell you that, like, from that moment to this, it's been an easy road, and I jumped right into Alcoholics Anonymous. But what happened was is that rehab would not take me back. They said that I was a liability to their facility, and they could not help me. And so my mom, we went back to my little apartment, and she would put me in a bath. She would fill, I had like a little bathtub and a shower, and she would fill my bathtub up and put towels at the base under the water because I was so bony that I couldn't lay down in the shower without it hurting. And she would sit there and she would bathe me. She tried to wash my hair. She went out to the mall and bought me some kids' clothes that would fit me. She bought me a plane ticket, and we flew back up to Maryland, and she said, you know, I'm going to send you to that facility that we sent you back. I actually have the same sobriety date. It's just 4 years apart. So, again, if you're going to tell me there's no God, like, I'm sorry. I just can't believe that. And, you know, I got back into that facility, and that facility told me, you're a liability. We can't help you, right? Like, you know, your health is too compromised, and we can't help you. So we're going to send you somewhere where you can get physically healthy, and you can come back, and we'll treat your alcoholism, you know. And I'm grateful, you know, that that facility was not some, you know, born-again Christian place or some scare straight place. They were 12-step based, you know, and they're still 12-step based. And, you know, I went to this other facility where they forced me to eat food and, you know, sleep and interact with humans, you know, because when I got sober, I couldn't talk. I couldn't read. Pretty much I would either just, like, scream at you or cry at you. You know, like, that's what I was capable of when I first got sober. And I was in that first facility for 30 days, and they said, you know, do you want to go back to that treatment center that sent you here, or do you want to go home? And I said, I want to go back to that treatment center, right? Because at that time, you know, I had, you know, I hate this phrase, but it's so true. I didn't have any tools in my toolkit, you know, like, you know, and I knew in that moment if I went home, I was going to drink again, you know. And I want to say I had enough. But if you would have asked me, I don't know that I would have told you that, you know. But I knew if I went home that I was going to drink again. And so I went back to that 12-step-based facility. And, you know, I did what I do in every facility. Like, I'm someone I succeed very well institutionalized, right? You serve me a hot meal. You tell me go to this lecture and go to that lecture, work these steps, talk to this counselor, pray and meditate, and I do it, right? Because, you know, I do very, very well in those environments. But what was different about this time was I wanted what you guys had, you know? And when they brought in speakers very much like this, I would sit in the front row rather than the back, you know, and I would go up after and I would thank them for taking the time to come out and speak, you know, because the facility that I was at, it's on the Eastern Shore and it is not close to anything. You know, it's like right on the bay, and people would drive an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, you know, just to talk to a hopeless drunk like me, you know, and know that I might not get sober, you know that I might just go back out there and do what I know how to do. And what happened for me is I was in that facility, I want to say, for like 14 days, and then the insurance ran out, and they were like, all right, you got to go. And they set me up in another halfway house. I went to the all-women's halfway house this time, right, and I started to take a little bit of direction. And it was in Columbia, Maryland. And I was up in Columbia, Maryland, and they have a lot of, like, clubhouse AA out there, which is great, right? It's great. But there weren't a lot of young people. And I was 22 when I got sober, 22, 23 when I got sober. And I just remember sitting in that room being like, I didn't lose a wife. I didn't lose a husband. I didn't lose a house. I didn't lose a car. And my life's not great now that I'm sober. You know, like, I did not relate to, I stopped drinking, everything's great now, you know. I stopped drinking and it felt like I was walking through life and it was a cheese grater, you know, like, that's how I felt, you know. I felt like I was going to either kill somebody or kill myself, you know. And I just remember this person at the rehab, they worked there, and they said, you know, Rachel, I hope I never see you again. I don't ever want to see you again. Just get out there and do what you have to do. You know, and so I kept going to meetings and kept going to meetings. And I can tell you, like, I feel like my first 3 months, every day I wanted to drink. Every single day. I would watch TV commercials for Coors Light, which was my drink of choice, and I would cry. I mean, I would, like, cry at the TV in this halfway house because all I wanted to do was drink, you know. I didn't have a sponsor. I wasn't working steps. You can best believe I wasn't helping anybody. And what happened for me is someone that I actually used to drink with when I lived in Maryland, they reached out to me and they said, hey, Rachel, I have 3 years sober. How are you doing? And I was like, well, I have 30 days sober and I want to kill myself, you know. And he laughed and he said, why don't I pick you up and take you to this young people's meeting? And I said, okay, you know. And, like, it's so funny, the type of ego I have, I was like, oh, he thinks I'm cute, and we're going to go on a date to the AA meeting. Like, that's what this is. It's a date, right? And so I, like, got all dressed up, did my hair, probably took, like, the second shower since I'd been out of rehab, brushed my teeth, you know, put on maybe some jeans that didn't have holes in them, you know. And he picked me up, and we went to this AA meeting, and we went to my home group. Right, which my home group is the Midtown group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was actually picking up my 60-day chip. I had 60 days that night. And at the time, the place we were at, it was BCC High School. And it's this huge auditorium. I mean, probably can seat 600 people. And it's got these really big stairs, like long stairs. And they say, you know, does anybody have 60 days? And I get up and I start to walk and I fall flat on my face, right? I just tripped. I mean, I'm like, you know, go figure. And what I can say about that is a bunch of women came up to me after the meeting because they knew I was the girl that tripped who picked up her 60-day chip. Because when they asked if anybody was new in AA or had under 30 days, you best believe I didn't stand up and say me, you know. But they saw the girl that tripped to pick up her chip. And, you know, that's where the miracle happened. You know, is I was overwhelmed. I started crying because I was just so freaked out at how many people were there. You know, I thought that you guys just wanted something from me that I couldn't give you. I felt like I wasn't worthy of sobriety. I felt like I wasn't worth your hugs when you gave it to me and you said it's going to be okay. You don't have to live that way anymore. You know, I really, really was ashamed of who I was. And, the women just love me, you know. I can't say, right, they, like, dropped these, like, profound, like, spiritual bombs on me and I got on fire for AA. You know, they just said, we love you and just stay in your seat, you know, just stay here. They didn't tell me, keep coming back, Rachel. They said, stay, don't go, you know. And so I listened. And I had actually had a sponsor at that time, and I wrote my fourth step. And during my fifth step, she looked at me and she said, I'm not alcoholic and I can't help you. And for someone like me, for something like that to happen, I said, well, I relate to this woman. Her story is just like my story, and she's not alcoholic. Maybe I'm not alcoholic, right? And so, you know, I'm sort of like, well, maybe this AA thing is just a cult. Maybe they're just stupid. Maybe I'm just a problem drinker. Maybe I'm just a heavy drinker. You know, maybe I just went through a phase. And lucky for me, I heard my current sponsor speaking at a meeting that I didn't want to go to with people I didn't want to be around. And my sponsor spoke. My sponsor is Joyce, although she won't tell you that she sponsors me because she's anonymous in AA. That's like a new thing we're practicing, being anonymous in AA. But she told her story from a podium very much like this. And when she talked about how her drinking was pathetic and disgusting, when she talked about how nobody wanted to be around her, when she talked about that she couldn't imagine her life with or without alcohol, that she had gone to, you know, that, you know, I will preface this is my opinion. I try to not be opinionated in Alcoholics Anonymous, but, you know, she said, I didn't have a bottom. I had many bottoms, you know, because I would dig myself and I would hit a bottom and I would dig a deeper bottom. And that's my experience. You know, I didn't have one bad night drinking and decided to get sober. I had many bad nights drinking. You know, I did many shameful things drinking. And I just related to her. And I was too afraid to ask her to be my sponsor. And so I do what any good person in their 20s does. And I messaged her on Facebook. And I said, hey, I heard you speak at this meeting. And I was just wondering if you were available to sponsor any more women. And she said, here's my number. Why don't you call me? And I was like, whoa, like, that's too much. You know what I mean? I don't like, I mean, if I wanted to call you, I would have asked you for your number. You know, like, I don't want to call you. And I called her, right? I called her because I just had that little bit of willingness. And I called her, and I really believe that that call saved my life. You know, do I think if she said, you know, no, I don't have time to sponsor you, would I have found another sponsor? Maybe. I don't know. You know, but luckily, when the hand of AA reaches out, she grabbed it, you know, and that's what I try to do. You know, that's my responsibility as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. When someone asks me for help, or even if they don't ask for my help, you know, if I'm available, I help them. And that's really where my journey in recovery began. You know, I mean, my sobriety had started well before that, but that's really where my recovery began. And, you know, my sponsor, if you know her, you know, she's a sharpshooter. You know, she was like, I want you to go to 7 meetings a week. I want you to get 3 service positions. And I want you to call me every day. And I was like, okay. You know, what do you say? I mean, for me, I don't know what to say to that. You know, I'm going to say okay. And so that's what I did, you know. I got a home group. I got 3 service positions, and I went to 7 meetings a week. And she told me, you're going to get a job. And I said, well, what does having a job have to do with drinking and not drinking? She said, you're just going to get a job, you know. And I'm grateful she never entertained my deep thought questions. You know, she just told me what to do, and I did it. And again, you know, I know people sponsor people different ways, but that's the type of sponsorship that I needed, you know. And what happened for me is, you know, I had a car when I got sober, and so I would drive to meetings by myself, you know, and my sponsor was like, oh, no, no, you're going to fill your car up with people you don't know. And I was like, that seems stupid. You know, I mean, I can get myself there, but I did it anyways, you know, and that's my sobriety, is doing stuff other people tell me to do because they've been sober longer than I have, you know. And my experience has been as if I don't even have to say yes. If I just say okay, you know, I'm on the right path. And, you know, I still fill my car up, you know. I still go to, you know, all the AA, we call them flows in our area, but they're little AA dances. We have little AA parties, and I remember I would go with a little bad attitude, and I'm like, oh, you guys are so stupid, and, you know, but I went, you know, and it's so funny, because the women that I help today, that's the type of attitude that they have, you know, and I just think that's really funny, but, you know, we started working the steps, right? She did not say, oh, I'm going to wait for you to be ready to work the steps. She said, you know, do you have a big book? I said, yeah, I have a big book. She said, all right, let's start reading it, you know, and we started reading the big book from that blank page to the very end, you know, and she talked to me about the forewords, which I thought were just stupid statistics, you know, And I remember reading the doctor's opinion and crying because for the first time in my life, I knew what was wrong with me. You know, all those psychiatrists, I did art therapy, light therapy, you know, all these different things, you know, and nobody knew what was wrong with Rachel. It was always take this pill, go to this therapy, you know, get a hobby, start working out, you know. But when I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew what was wrong with me, and I knew what I suffered from. And the great thing about that is there is a solution for it, you know. And it was described to me as if I do the 12 steps in a 12-step program, I will get better, you know. And I needed a guarantee like that. You know, my sponsor didn't tell me, I promise you you'll get a husband. I promise you you'll get a house on the hill. I promise you you'll get a six-figure job and never worry about money or death in your life. She just said, I promise you won't ever have to take a drink again if you work these 12 steps and help other alcoholics, you know. And that's my experience. That's my sobriety, you know. And my life is tremendously different, you know, tremendously. But that doesn't mean that I haven't had really hard times. You know, my dad has multiple sclerosis. He has had multiple sclerosis for 16 years. And in my second year of sobriety, he was hospitalized twice. You know, and the first time he was hospitalized, I didn't show up, you know. I didn't show up. I was too afraid. I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to face my father, you know. But the second time he was hospitalized, I had made amends, you know. I had gone back, met with him face to face. Not only did I say sorry, but I said, what can I do to make it right? And he said, I just want you to stay sober, right? And part of me staying sober is showing up in situations like that. And I had to shave my father's face for him. I had to brush his teeth. I had to change his clothes. I had to yell at nurses because I thought they weren't taking care of him like how I could, you know. I had to bring him, you know, fast food because the hospital food, he wouldn't eat it. But, you know, I would have missed it. I would have missed all of it. You know, had I been drinking, you know, they wouldn't have known where I was to even call me to tell me, hey, this is happening, you know. And while I wish I didn't have to do things like that, I get to do things like that, you know. And my mother had to have emergency surgery my first year of sobriety, and I was able to show up. But you know what else showed up with me was members of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they came to that hospital, and they sat in the waiting room with me, you know. And when my dad finally was able to come home, people brought food to his house, you know. People sat with my mom and just treated her like a normal person rather than a wife with a sick husband, you know. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, you know. And, you know, I think for me, like, I don't really like, you know, speaking from a podium. I feel like, you know, I'm most useful, like, one-on-one with people. So, like, this is very, very uncomfortable for me. But, you know, I have been taught here that when Alcoholics Anonymous asks, I say yes, no matter how far, no matter how close, no matter if it's been raining for 6 days, you know, that I get in the car and I go to the meeting, you know. And I think, you know, for me, like, you guys, not only did you say, come with us, we have room for one more. You said, oh, we're going to make you coffee chair. And I felt real special. You know, I felt really, really special making coffee, you know, and being a coffee chair at that, you know, not just on the team, but a chair, you know. And then you guys said, oh, you can make cookies at this meeting. I said, oh, you like my cookies? Okay, I can make cookies for your meeting, you know. And I had no idea that, like, anybody can make cookies. Anybody can make coffee. But you guys made me feel special, you know. You made me feel, you know, wanted. And for someone who felt so unwanted, you know, that's what I needed. And, you know, my sponsor, once I had worked the 12 steps, she said, all right, now you're going to practice them in your life every day. And she said, you know, you're going to be of service for the rest of your life, you know. And I remember when she told me that, I was like, you got to be kidding me, you know. Like, I didn't get sober to be of service for the rest of my life, you know. And I can tell you my attitude towards that has changed, you know. It's a gift to be of service, whether it's to someone who's suffering from alcoholism or someone who's not. You know, I don't just, I don't believe in 1 hour sobriety where I come to a meeting and I say, hurrah, hurrah for AA, let's clean up some chairs, let's shake some hands, let's help some newcomers, you know. I really do try when, you know, I'm outside the meeting, you know, making sure I call my mom every day on my lunch break, you know, making sure I show up to work, you know, half an hour early, like my sponsor told me to show up to the meeting at least half an hour early. You know, I try to you know, when I go to my parents' house, help clean up, you know, just like you guys taught me how to clean up after a meeting. You know, I really do believe that, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, has provided me with a way of life, right? A way of life that I don't deserve. And you know, I try to thank God every day that I get what I don't deserve. You know what I mean? Because I don't deserve this life, you know. I don't deserve the friends that I have. I don't deserve the family that I have, you know, but I have it, you know. And I believe that, you know, God, which is what I just call my higher power. You know, I call my higher power God. It's one syllable. It's easy to remember, and I don't forget, you know. But God has provided me with this life, so I should show up for it, you know. Good, bad, indifferent, you know, happy times, sad times. And, you know, I just know for me, like, I think probably the greatest gift in the little over 4 years sober is when I watch someone come in who's dying of alcoholism, who may want what we have, may not want what we have, right? But they take the actions necessary, and all of a sudden, like, their eyes are no longer these, like, dark circles, you know? Like, they have that light. They have that light that we all have, you know? And I know that, you know, I play a very, very small part in that, you know, whether it's shaking someone's hand, whether it's bringing them a cup of coffee because they're shaking so bad that they can't hold it, you know, whether it's, there's, you know, something I've seen that drives me crazy sometimes is, you know, if there's that one person who might be drunk in a meeting, the last person there, and they have no ride home, and no one's offered them a ride, I will take you home, you know what I mean? Like, you know, I really do believe in our traditions, and if someone has a desire to stop drinking, I have a desire to share my solution, you know, and, I'm just really grateful for my life today, and I hope that I don't ever forget that, and I hope that, you know, I do believe that when I start to think that I've built this life, you know, and it's been all me, I'm glad my sponsor's there to tell me that, you know, you're an idiot, you know, that's what she tells me when I come to her, she's like, you're an idiot, you know, and I'm glad that she does that, you know, and I'm glad that I've had the same sponsor for these 4 years, you know, and I'm glad that, you know, not only has she watched my life get better, but I've watched her life get better, you know, and that I get to come here and be with you guys on a Sunday night and on every night. So with that, I'm really grateful for my sobriety, and thanks for letting me share.